Welcome back to the New History Podcast, everyone. We're here on episode 10. I'm joined by Lily, as always.
Hello.
And returning once again from Accessible Art History, we've got Annalisa.
Hello.
Hello. So as you can probably guess, we're talking about art history again. One particular period, I believe. So I'll hand it over to the experts to run away with it.
Okay, well, today we are talking about Baroque, Baroque art, Baroque architecture, just Baroque in general, because Baroque is cool and everyone needs to know more about it. And that's what we're doing today, much to Alex's dismay.
Well, I could certainly do with knowing more about it, it seems. So.
So we are kind of going to try and follow a similar structure to what we did on our last podcast with Annalisa. We had James and he did a nice sort of introduction for context. For people like Alex who don't necessarily know a lot about art or, you know, what's happening around it. And then we have some pieces that we will go in super detail because Annalisa has a very nice list and I have some random bits and bits to put together. And that's how this is going to flow. So first of all, I am going to describe Baroque in very simple terms for those of you listening who may not know what we're talking about. So when we talk about Baroque, it's not just art. That's what I kind of want to put out there. It's affected culture and a variety of arts, and it was generally just a wider movement that happened in history. The period, normally speaking, goes from the 17th century up until the mid-18th century, although there are some parts in the world where the Baroque lasted a lot longer, such as in Portugal and in Spain, as well as the Portuguese and the Spanish colonies, but it went all the way up to the early 1800s. So it's a wide spectrum of different artistic movements that sort of shared themes. And another thing that I always tell people when talking about Baroque is that it's a very, although there are common characteristics, Baroque is a very sort of personalized style to each country and each nation, and almost locations within the same nation, because it has so much personality and so much drama, like we were saying in the previous sort of pre-recording time, that sometimes you find these quirky little things about Baroque that don't necessarily follow the general trend. But that's what makes Baroque so special and why it stayed as a trend for such a long time, because it was a wonderful way of telling so many different stories. Why did Baroque happen? Well, we're going to have to go back a few more centuries. And it's really something that kicks off after the Council of Trent in the mid-1500s, we had lots of different reformations in the church. And eventually, the Catholic Church has a very strong passion to go against the movements of the Reformation in what regarded art. Art became sort of more somber, I guess we could say. And the Counter-Reformation was like, no, let's be happy about our artistic expression. And it was really a way for the church to sort of bring back, particularly the Catholic Church, to bring back a lot of the passion that had been pushed aside by the reformists throughout Europe. So that's the reason why it sort of goes over the top, because they kind of felt like they had to overcompensate for previous movements like the Renaissance or Mannerism, which, although impressive in their own terms, sort of kept things a lot more, I don't want to say toned down, but I guess toned down is the right word if you think of Baroque and the ridiculous extents of detail and things that we can go into. So the key thing about this style is that it's exuberant. If you see a Baroque painting or a Baroque sculpture or anything, there's just a lot of it. And even in the smallest paintings, so many things are happening. There's so much technique, so much story to tell. So that's really what characterizes this style and the amount of detail. Sometimes it can be a bit overwhelming. And I've actually seen this happening a lot when you go into art galleries. Like sometimes, you know, people get quite affected by all of the images and they need time out. In the Baroque sections, it happens particularly because there's just so much stuff going on. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed with things like that. And if any of you have ever been to the National Art Gallery in London, you will actually notice that Baroque areas tend to be quite big, not just because the paintings are huge, but partially it's also so that you can take in everything that's happening without feeling so overwhelmed.
I guess you don't want to see too many of them at once.
Yeah, like it seriously can be a bit like, whoa, okay, too many details. Nice. So that's how it goes. Baroque originally started in Rome, like most things happened, and it developed all the way in different countries up until the more eccentric part of Baroque, which is Rococo, or some people call it later Baroque, which actually originates in France.
I'm guessing there's no like clear start and end point like with most periods of anything.
Well, yes and no. Some people have determined that it was the work done at the Church of the Gesù in Rome that was the cutting point. And that actually puts us in sort of mid-16th century. But because there was a lot of transition between mannerism and just the early stages of Baroque, and Baroque doesn't really look the same in some places, it's hard to tell. But that is, theoretically speaking, what most people sort of assume the first Baroque piece was, because it took away sort of the classic simplicity that was predominant over the Renaissance and mannerism, and it kind of took it a step farther into, whoa, let's put some stuff in here. And then things just kind of went crazy from there on.
Was it kind of identified as a new style right from the beginning, or?
Not necessarily. I think in this particular case, it was kind of down to the artist and to the sculptures particularly. And that happens a lot with art and art history. Sometimes things sort of change definitions and stuff like that because someone else comes around and says, actually, this wasn't a precursor. This was just someone doing their own thing. At the time, it probably wouldn't have been understood as such. And I mean, if you compare the timing, you know, we're saying that the vast majority of Baroque as a thing happened from the 17th century onwards. We're almost taking 50 years prior to what seems to be the origin and the precursor to a movement that spread a lot farther and that took it a lot farther than what the Church of the Gesù does in Rome. So that is sort of the original seed, if you like, and then things just took it on from there. And for those of you who may not be necessarily familiar with this type of period and transitions and everything that happens during this time, it's not just about the changes in the church. Obviously, the changes in the church were very important, and we have the Lutherans and the Catholics going at each other's throats for quite some time. But, you know, this is a period in European history that is quite turbulent. Here we start seeing empires rise and fall. And of course, that sort of artistic expression comes out somewhere. But a lot of the original efforts of Baroque come from the religious art. And that's the reason why churches are the main starting point and some of the main and earlier evidences of Baroque that we have around Europe. And not just the churches themselves, but the inside of the churches and the art that comes from there onwards as well. I think that sort of covers that up. So I've already said that it's super ornate and the sort of extent that it goes over to. And we have obviously some key paintings and painters, and the problem is everywhere has a masterpiece. This is why it was so difficult for us to pick where to focus on. But we will go through those in a moment. But you will probably hear us talking about some main areas because they were so important for the development of this style. We have a big impact coming into Baroque from France, which is interesting because the French didn't really experience Baroque to its fullest. They kind of resisted the development of Baroque for a really long time. But interestingly enough, France really pushed forward for Baroque style in other artistic aspects, which I'll mention very briefly, and that mostly have to do with music. It was actually the court of Louis XIV that started the origins of ballet as close to ballet as we know it these days in Europe. And there is a very famous picture of Louis XIV in his Apollo costume for the Ballet de la Royale de la Nuit in 1653. And they also really pushed for a lot of other musical developments at the time. And this is really a period, really great period for music, not just for art, because we have people like Vivaldi, Bach, and Handel composing. And this is the moment when we have the introduction of piano, which most people associate these days with classic music, but it didn't really come up until this moment in time. But it's also a wonderful time for literature. So as you can see, it's not just art. It's everything is booming at this current moment in time. We have huge developments in theater, particularly in Spain and France. And some names may be familiar to you guys, such as Racine and Molière. In France, Molière is considered sort of the godfather of theater and current drama stage and that sort of stuff. And in Spain, we have big names such as Lope de Vega and Calderón de la Barca that really move forward literature and will inspire generations to come. So there's different bits all going on, and there is a lot of retrofeedback between different pieces of artistic input and art and vice versa. So there's a lot going on. And there's so many politics and so many things happening that every single ruler and every single pope and everyone that kind of was alive during this moment in time wanted to really have an impact and take that style and make it their own and put it out there. So there is a lot going on. Yeah, a lot. A lot going on. But for today, mostly, we will focus on art, architecture, and sculpture. And as we are not really going to cover this, I will also mention one of France's biggest contribution to Baroque was actually a lot of mobiliary art. There's a lot of furniture making that happens in France during this time. And it's quite interesting because, you know, you kind of go to castles, palaces, you know, things like that. And a lot of the pieces that you end up seeing even these days, unless they're very modern, they tend to be from the Baroque, because that's when we have some great developments in mobiliary art, because places like Versailles were getting their extension, and therefore kings like Louis XIV wanted to have the best that they could to obviously adorn such an iconic palace. And for those of you who don't know, Baroque is actually the reason why we have the commode as a concept. There you go. And that's a sort of quick overview of all of the stuff that happens in not a lot of time, because I could go on forever. But yeah, that's the reason why this is such a ridiculous topic and such a big topic. And there is probably 3,000 podcasts. We could probably do a podcast just on Baroque forever.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Because, you know, there is literally just so much stuff. But I hope that sort of covers the vast majority of things. So just to summarize, you know, this is very heavily influenced by the church, particularly the Catholic Church. This is all based up on the exuberance and the excess of ornament and detail. And it's not just art and architecture, it's everything else that happens around. And it's a lot of the time driven not just by the politics of the church, but also the national inputs that all of the different European countries and their colonies are having at the time, because whether you're rising or falling, as it happens with places like Portugal or Spain, that type of massive reaction has a big impact in the population. And obviously, you know, those are always the moments when we see big artistic movements coming through, when stuff's happening and when things sort of start going a bit rocky in different places. So there you go. That hopefully covers that.
Cool, yeah.
Very well done. Brilliant.
Literally trying to keep it condensed. I was flicking through my notes like, no.
Well, I was able to follow that, so you did a good job.
One thing I did want to add was a way that I've always remembered, because we have the Renaissance and Mannerism, and then we have this explosion of the Baroque, is one way I've always encouraged people to remember it is that the Renaissance was more about the rational. It's balanced and it's scientific. And then you can almost consider the Baroque to be the irrational. It's the emotional and it's the dramatic side of humanity. And so that's why it's such a big deal to have this shift in art, because we went from this, you know, the scientific works of people like Leonardo da Vinci to the emotional crazy works of Caravaggio, which we'll discuss in a little bit. And it's just so interesting to see that in such a short period of time that Western Europe as a whole kind of collectively shifted this mindset of the emotion that art could bring as opposed to the thoughts that art could bring.
Yep. Mm.
That makes sense. I mean, I can't think of any examples right now, but I think things are always kind of reacting to the thing before, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, when Baroque finishes, then we start moving into neoclassicism anyway. So they always seem to go on a loop. And if you think it that way, medieval art, in a way, is very different from Renaissance art because it's also about that sort of immaterial emotion that is, you know, created with different materials, with different techniques, with all these sort of stuff. And in fact, Baroque often borrows many things from the Middle Ages because of that sense of longing and that sense of drama.
Right. Yeah.
So it's quite interesting how those two type of movements sort of repeat themselves over and over in art and art history and history overall, because we see it in literature as well, we see it in music. And it's the two currents, and I guess it's the two parts of humanity, right? We have our rational brain of way and doing things, and then we have our emotions, which of course have always been a good precursor for any type of artistic input. So there you go. But yeah, that's...
I think we just got really deep into some psychology right there.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, absolutely. So unless Alex has any questions or anything he wants us to clarify, I think it would be good to start going into some of these examples. And with that, you also get a better sort of feeling of how things change and how Baroque really developed.
I did want to ask, where does the term come from? And does it mean anything?
Well,
that won't take too long.
There is actually, you know what? You've kind of opened a bit of a bag.
There's a lot of different theories of what it means.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff. Like, there is even contradictions as to or different opinions as to where the word Baroque actually comes from. I mean, the actual word Baroque is a French word in origin.
Okay.
But some people have gone as far as to think that it comes from like the Latin word for wart, which kind of has the same feeling or the same meaning to the word barroco, which is how we call it in Spanish and in Portuguese, which sort of comes to mean like a pearl or some form of, you know, precious thing that has some form of imperfection, I guess.
Okay.
This way you can call it. But yeah, I mean, there is loads of different theories about it, but in essence, the word itself, even already in for French philosophers and throughout time, it sort of came to express that it was something just ridiculously over the top, confusing and unnecessary.
Okay.
And so that's kind of what it comes to signify. And I mean, in a way, if you're looking at it from a very logical lens, I guess that may be what some people may feel about Baroque, that it's just too much and too over the top. But, you know, the important thing to remember, and I think what is most important for people to pick from this, is that regardless of the actual origin of the word, it wasn't properly used as a thing to describe stuff up until, I think, it was the late 18th century. It was mostly used for the description of music as Baroque, and it actually had a negative connotation.
You can see that happening with a few other things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you were a musician at the time and people said you were Baroque, it probably meant that you were overdoing it or that they didn't like you. So there you go. But yeah, that's sort of where it comes from. But there is a huge, huge discussion in academia about the actual concept of Baroque and what it means. So
I'll let you stop there then.
Yeah, because it actually gets quite vicious at stages.
Of course.
We'll skip that part and whoop.
Yeah. Cool.
Etymology is always fun, but not this time.
Right, well. always interesting. Anyway, enough interruptions from me. I'll let you carry on.
No, that's fine. So out of the very long list of pieces and things that we had, I think we have some paintings, some sculptures.
Yep, I picked two paintings and a sculpture to give a little variety.
Excellent. And I have some buildings as well. So if you want to get started, Annalisa, and we'll move from there.
Absolutely. All right. So let's start with the sculpture. One of my personal favorite sculptures, not only because I like it and I want to talk about it, but also because it really embodies the meaning of the Baroque period, as especially connected with the Counter-Reformation. So we're talking about Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. It's a really controversial piece, but I think that's part of what makes it so fun, is that there is this discussion and this controversy around it. So if you don't know, Gian Lorenzo Bernini was a Baroque master, and he was well-beloved by the popes. He worked with a bunch of them to not only create art for churches, but he also helped build some of the most important buildings and sites in Rome that we still enjoy today, like the Piazza of St. Peter's Basilica. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't gone there, I highly recommend trying to get over to Rome someday after this pandemic is over, because there's just so much amazing, not just Baroque art and architecture, but like everything else. But so the Ecstasy of St. Teresa was sculpted between 1647 and 1652, and it's located in the Carnaro Chapel in Santa Maria della Vittoria. It's a beautiful church, but this is definitely the highlight of the building, and it's kind of off the beaten path, so you do have to look for the church, but totally worth the trek. And it shows Teresa of, I'm probably butcher this because my Spanish is 13 years old, of Avila.
Yep.
And she was a mystic saint, and she lived about a century and a half before Bernini was living. And she was a Spanish nun who had a lot of visions of both Christ and angels, and she wrote them down. And this book that she created really helped drive the Counter-Reformation, because it showed people a connection to God that maybe they couldn't feel before. So this particular sculpture shows one of her visions in which an angel came down to from heaven and basically plunged a spear into her heart, and it caused her this pain, but it was like a beautiful, sweet pain that helped her experience the love of God. And I highly recommend you look at the artwork. At one point, maybe, you know, if you're driving listening to this, don't do it. But when you get home or something, pull it up, because it's a little funky. You can see her emotion on her face. And I don't want to get too far into it, because this is an art history podcast, but it's almost a little sexual in nature, and that is the biggest controversy.
Probably downplaying.
Okay, it's really, really, really sexual. Okay, it's a very interesting facial expression. I'll let you interpret that when you see it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And it shocked people. Like, you put this in a chapel, in a church, but Bernini was like, "Hey, I'm just trying to show what she was feeling." Her connection to God, that's what this is about. And her back is arched and her mouth is open and her eyes are closed. It's very almost erotic in nature. And it shocked me the first time I saw it. And, you know, I will admit, the first time I heard about this painting, I was in eighth grade, or the sculpture, excuse me, in eighth grade reading Angels and Demons by Dan Brown. And I was like, whoa, this is inappropriate for an eighth grader. Besides the rich emotion on Teresa's face, we also see the drama of the story, where the angel is flying in from the side. It's almost as if he flies in and pushes the spear and is kind of in the process of piercing her, whereas in earlier works, we kind of see a more stagnant, like he would just be holding the spear. So it was all about helping the viewer to understand, but also experience Teresa's ecstasy and bring them closer to God.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That description does kind of ring a bell, so.
Yeah, oh yeah, I mean, it's very famous, not just because of the controversy, but because, like, the actual execution of the piece is ridiculous. But I would say this hands up, Bernini is definitely not one of my favorites. Whatsoever.
No, I'm so disappointed in you.
I know. I'm so sorry. I think one of the problems that I have with Bernini is a little similar to the problem I have with Michelangelo, which is they were almost so good that that this belief you need to put yourself in to sort of think that was done by a human hand is a bit too much for me. There is almost no room for imperfection. And and I don't
too
know.
Perfect.
It, yeah, and I know maybe that sounds ridiculous, and you know, I can appreciate the ridiculous amount of skill that him and people like Michelangelo obviously had, but it, yeah. For me sometimes it's a bit like, okay, yeah, all right, show off, whatever. If that
no,
makes
I get
sense.
That.
But one of the things that I also love about this painting, sculpture, is that the drapery goes crazy. Like, it literally is everywhere. And it's just amazing the amount of movement that was put into this piece of marble.
It
kind of goes to reflect that, you know, that sense of baroque of, was it really necessary to add so many folds into the clothes? Probably
tons
not.
Of detail.
It literally makes the whole thing look completely surreal. And it really brings that sort of feeling of, I think it really adds to the whole ecstasy of theme of the actual sculpture itself. Because it sort of gives you the impression that, again, without wanting to take this to a sort of not safe for workplace, it kind of gives you the impression that this woman is so completely, I don't know, out of her mind in this process, literally almost like in trance or tripping, that her clothes are going all over the place and all of this is happening. It really kind of gives you that feeling of, wow, okay. What's going on here?
I feel like you do get this kind of, I mean, what little I know of what actually is Baroque, but you get this kind of sexual element from some of it, don't you? With lots of detailed bodies and stuff, doing all sorts of things.
Oh yeah, 100%.
It doesn't seem that weird to me.
Of course,
this being a sexual as well.
It is definitely something that appears as part of the of the movement itself. I think often you see it a lot more in paintings. Like, I can think of a fair few where it's not even subtle or implicit, it's explicit. And that's fine, because one of the whole, you know, important things that artists throughout Baroque wanted to really do was sort of capture the reality of things, the plausibility that this could be a real thing that could be happening right in front of your eyes. A lot of the Baroque artists and sculptures and things like that just have this absolute desire to make you believe this could be a human, an actual human in front of you. But obviously in painting or in sculpture, whatever it is. So they take it to a completely, you know, range of different topics that it's new as well. Because if we think about how sex and some of those things have been sort of considered in previous periods, particularly with Lutheranism and iconoclastic movements and things like that, wanting to tone things down, it kind of pushes for that other barrier of, no, we're going to take it completely to the opposite end. And it's also because it borrows often from like things like mythology and whatnot. And obviously we all know with people like Zeus hanging around, this sort of stuff is bound to happen. But it is interesting and of course kind of bewildering that it happened in a religious piece, and not just a religious piece, but something that is, you know, at the seat of power of the Pope. Because you would think out of all of the people who may be a bit more prudish towards the representation of sex or a sexualized image, the Catholic Church would definitely be there. But, well,
I mean, we can say plenty of things about the Catholic Church.
Yeah. So there
you
go.
Well, the popes of that period weren't very
based,
I guess we could say. I mean, Renaissance popes as well, they were more of a temporal power and concerned with the world and the worldly aspects. But it's definitely an interesting piece. And when you were talking about the drapery and the dramatic folds of the cloth, it made me think that it kind of is almost like there's a gust of wind coming in, if we're facing this work from the left-hand side, and that goes with the angel whooshing in and her robes are being flung almost if, you know, they were a couple inches higher. Be even more explicit, and it's just this dynamic sense of movement where we didn't necessarily have that. If you think back to Renaissance sculpture or even medieval sculpture, where things were very, very stiff. And we did have a sense of body, but not as much as the way the body moves as opposed to a body at rest.
Yep, 100%. And that whole thought of the gust of wind, I think when you kind of bring that into the sort of imagination of what's happening here, really sort of helps you bring everything together. So nice pickup in there.
I just love this work so much. I know you're not a huge fan of Bernini, but
like I said, it's my bar of what is too good. He's just a bit above it. And I like things with a slight flow or with a slight sense of humanity in there. And there is plenty of humanity in here.
Just not the kinds that you're looking for.
Exactly. Exactly. It just doesn't seem part of the execution. It almost seems like this would have been cut with laser. And totally. It sort of takes me back a little bit. It stops me from connecting, if that makes sense. But there you go.
Oh, that's totally very different perspective than mine. And I really actually appreciate it because it's actually giving me a new way to view works by people like Bernini and Michelangelo. Whereas, because for me, the one pivotal moment of me discovering art history and being like, this is what I want to do with my life, was actually Michelangelo's Pietà and being like, this, how is this physically possible to have been sculpted by a person?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see, like, you're kind of on the same spectrum, but also the other side of it. So,
yeah.
And I find it very interesting.
Yeah, it's and
some people just want to see some brushstrokes and some tool marks, I guess.
Yeah, I think for me, when you see something like that, it kind of, it's almost like the artist left a residue of what happened, and it kind of makes me think, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but, I can appreciate
you know, and I'm you know, like I said, Bernini is and will always be a master, not just of Baroque, but of art in general. And I'm not taking any credit away from him. It's just that for me, I remember getting to know his work and sort of going like, I mean, okay, you know, when it's just a bit too much and you're like, I don't even know what else to do with this. I'm just gonna go into the next thing because it generally sort of made me feel so overwhelmed to the point of being underwhelmed. Like it's so good that I don't know what else to do with it. So I'm just gonna take a step back and let it be. But it's, you know, 100%, you cannot talk about Baroque and sculpture without naming Bernini, because almost everything that came after that is a Bernini plagiarism. No offense to any artist, but it is, because he set the standard so high. And of course, the patrons that he had, you know, kind of, it was kind of a way of for everyone to look up to him and sort of be like, I want to be as good as that guy and have the same amount of patronage that that guy is having. Because literally, like, half of the sculptures in just the Vatican and Rome alone are his. So, you know, it's a great achievement.
You can't avoid him.
Yeah, you generally can't. You would have to walk through Rome with your eyes closed.
Pretty much.
Indeed. Excellent.
Should we move on to the next one?
Yeah, I don't have another sculpture because I wanted to give Bernini the place that he deserved, despite my bias. So here we go.
I don't either. I just have a couple paintings as well. Yep. Do you want me to go next?
Yep.
Or do you want to? Okay, perfect. So you also, as you couldn't talk about Baroque sculpture without talking about Bernini, you can't talk about Baroque painting without talking about Caravaggio.
No, you
can't. And I like to call him the bad boy of the Baroque period.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was a horrible person. Like, he was an amazing artist, and his work is breathtakingly beautiful and emotional. But he also murdered someone over a tennis match. And he also threw, like, scalding oil on a waiter because his artichokes weren't cooked properly.
Yeah.
Mm. So he was kind of like the OG Karen.
Yeah.
But a man. So... Anyway, I had to mention that because I think it's important that we understand the artist behind the works. And as beautiful as they are, he was still not a good person.
Yep.
But his full name is Michelangelo Merce de Caravaggio, but we often just call him Caravaggio. And the work I'm going to be talking about today is one of his most famous paintings. It's called The Conversion on the Way to Damascus. It was painted in 1601, and it still resides in the church in which it was painted for, which is Santa Maria del Popolo in Rome. And it shows the moment when Saul became Paul, aka one of the most important figures in early Christianity. And for those of you who don't know, Paul was a Jewish Roman citizen who was actually working with the authorities to persecute the early Christians. But on his way to Damascus, he had a vision of Christ that was so powerful, it actually knocked him off of his horse. And he converted to Christianity, changed his name to Paul, and began spreading the word of Christ's message all over the Middle East and eventually in Rome. And his letters make up the majority of the New Testament. Paul is really important for Roman Christianity and their culture because he actually was beheaded there in the, I think, the late 60s CE, early 70s. It's a little contested. But he's super important. You see him all over Rome in churches and works of art. And I absolutely think this work captures Caravaggio's style because it's dramatic in both its composition and its lighting. So Caravaggio is the inventor of a term we call tenebrism in art history today, which essentially just means light and dark are really contrasting. So if you're looking at this work, you'll see that part of the horse is illuminated while more of the hind end area is dark and you kind of have to search to see if he even has a tail. Mm-hmm. And that's because the light is coming actually from the top of the painting because it's meant to represent Jesus and the vision striking Paul and almost it incapacitates him. He's on the ground. His arms are thrown up. His eyes are closed. His legs are splayed. It's literally he fell off of a horse while riding it. Like, that sounds pretty painful, but Paul doesn't care. The man who was guiding the horse is even looking down like, what the heck just happened to you, buddy? Are you good? Are you dead? Like, what's going on? And but also the work, it's really tight. Like, you are forced to take in this scene and can't. There's no extraneous details. There's no scenery. We can't tell if they're in the woods, on a road, that's all clear. Like, we don't know where this is other than it's Damascus on the way there because of the title. And so Caravaggio is really confronting the viewer with this moment of conversion. And it has a strong counter-reformation message. I mean, at this point in history, the Protestant Reformation had been occurring for around 80 years, and people were going to these new churches like Lutheranism. And this is Caravaggio and the papacy saying, it's okay to come back. It's okay to reconvert. Because look at Paul. He was Jewish and he was persecuting. And then he became one of the most important figures for us. So you can be like Paul. And so it's all of these different elements combined in a work that looks pretty simple. But as we know with the Baroque, nothing is ever simple.
So was this kind of a piece of commissioned propaganda for the Catholic Church, essentially?
Yes. So the chapel itself where it's in was actually for a very rich and powerful family in Rome. And so it wasn't uncommon for them to have ties to the papacy. And so they commissioned it to decorate their family chapel. But because it was within a larger church, it had that propaganda message built within it.
I really like the contrast in this and some of the other stuff I was just looking at of his. Yeah, that definitely appeals to me. And looking at this, of course, my eye immediately gets drawn to the sword and the helmet and stuff like that.
I knew you were going.
Yeah, I just love how we always get this anachronistic stuff in here where obviously it's Roman and we've got a sword with like a side ring on there and everything. Interesting.
To make a terrible joke, that's a double-edged sword. Because Paul was actually beheaded.
Okay.
So it's also an allusion to his martyrdom as well as to his Roman citizenship.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But whereas looking at that, like, if I didn't know what this was supposed to be, I wouldn't say it looks Roman at all, obviously. But maybe at the time when it was made, you know, that's what they thought they might have looked like.
That's probably likely because they didn't, the archaeological knowledge, they kind of made a lot of stuff up as they went along.
Yep, pretty much. It looks cool, so we put it in.
Yeah, you get that with every period. Yeah. It's just any biblical art that you see from throughout the medieval period and everything, it's always completely anachronistic on what people are wearing and everything. It's always interesting to see.
It's more of a close enough kind of thought process.
Yeah.
I have a couple of things to say about this painting, if that's okay.
Absolutely. There's one, I love the discussion.
One of the things that I love most, and for those of you who perhaps are looking to sort of get to recognize Baroque paintings in contrast to other paintings. There is one thing that happens very clearly on this painting several times, apart from the contrast of light known as tenebrism, which is the use of diagonals. These are very pronounced in the painting. You can see it in the position of the horse. You kind of have the hinder quarter very, very much on a perfect sort of 45 angle with the corner of the painting all the way down, like the horse sort of arses back down. And even the posture under which the figure is laying down on the floor has a little sort of diagonal angle. And this is something that is used a lot in Baroque painting overall, not just Caravaggio, but Caravaggio was just very good at making these very pronounced because of the light contrast. Mm-hmm. And it's also a way of giving you perspective. And we see this in a lot more detailed paintings. Without getting into details, because you know we probably have this coming, but Rubens was particularly good at doing this, sort of cramming a painting with people and using that diagonal to sort of give you different levels of perspective and distance. But also because it helps you be immersed into the painting itself. Because, I mean, the image is not sitting flat. You kind of have to approach it from an angle, and that angle sort of invites you into the scene. And that's what makes that sort of approachability that Baroque artists wanted to portray so accessible, that sort of disposition, not just of the light, but the actual image itself. And I just sort of thought that this is a very good example, and it probably will be useful for the examples coming forward. But just any time that if you are in an art gallery and you're sort of wondering, is it Baroque, is it not? If it has that sort of massive change of contrast between light and dark and that diagonal, it is Baroque, or an imitation, in which case it's Baroque anyway. I also wanted to mention very briefly, I read it somewhere, I can't remember what it is. I think it is in my compilation of the Art of Caravaggio, but I could be wrong, that these, if we look very closely at how the body is on the floor, we have that feeling of sort of falling into the ground and sort of realism. But in a way, and it's funny that we've mentioned Bernini before, there is that sort of ecstatic look and feel as well, which again is just so related to this, you know, Catholic Church putting forward these mystic apparitions, these sudden realizations of God and everything that
God
happens.
God makes you feel good.
And not just good. I think, you know, it's the reason why he ends up falling off the horse is because he has this epiphany. You know, it's the ultimate call to church, to God, is that sort of moment of wow. And that's very much captivated in here. And also, fun story about this painting. This painting had several versions, and the one we've ended up with, and that is most known, is almost the third one, because there was a first version, the patron didn't like it at all, but they ended up taking it anyway. And that is currently, I think, in the Balbi collection, if I remember correctly.
You are correct, yes.
It actually had a very different style. It was more on a mannerism style, because this painting is actually very early on in Baroque, which is also the reason why it's so important mention it, because it really definitely sets a trend. And
Paul was more naked in that one too.
100%. And then I think when they've done checks into the painting, you know, for conservation and things like that, there are layers underneath this painting of Caravaggio that suggest the panels were executed differently to begin with. And whether he didn't like it or the patron changed his mind again, they were repainted. So I always like knowing these things because, you know, it's not as simple of, oh, yeah, I had this wonderful idea for this painting and this is what I'm going to do. You know, the process can be so, so dramatic. And in the case of Caravaggio and of this painting in particular, I've always wondered if part of the reason why he ended up doing such a drastic change was because of the sort of rejection that he received from the first painting that was commissioned. Like, oh, this is not good enough, fine, then I'm going to do something so dramatic, you're not going to be able to say no. But who knows, he was a pretty eccentric guy, so it could be, or it could just be coincidence, but that's how we ended up with this.
First version, there's a lot more going on there. It's a lot so it's interesting how it kind of got simpler in a way with the new version.
Yeah.
When Baroque is meant to be, you know, over the top.
But if you think about it, the over the topness here comes from a different perspective, and it's a lot more humane, which is, you know, part of that motivation of the Baroque artist, of actually bringing you in with that emotion. Whilst the previous painting, I think it sort of brings you in because there's a lot of stuff happening. Mm-hmm. But here, you're kind of forced to look down and see what's happening to kind of get the whole picture together and understand this is what happened to Poole. This is how it all came to be. That was what I wanted to add to this.
Cool.
I was going to mention, I completely forgot to talk about the actual church itself is a very important Baroque icon. Well, Roman icon in general, because the church Santa Maria del Popolo, and I got to spend quite a bit of time in Rome, so I'm going to discuss my own personal experiences.
Nice.
It is an incredible church. There is so much art and symbolism packed into this one building, but actually it's an important, you know, we've got St. Peter's, we've got the Lateran, but Santa Maria del Popolo is actually the site of where there was an icon believed to be painted by St. Luke, like a portrait almost of the Virgin and Jesus. And so this church was one of the central churches in Rome. And so when it was redone in the Baroque style and the interior decorations, it was definitely part of the Counter-Reformation of let's re-anchor in this sacred site. And there's also Bernini sculptures in here, as well as a couple other Caravaggio paintings. So the choice of where to put these works were very deliberate. And I like coming back to the Counter-Reformation. That's kind of my thing with Baroque, because it's this whole idea of propaganda and then also beauty in propaganda. So I just wanted to bring that up because it's an interesting little tidbit.
Yep. No, I love that. It's great. And yeah, the context is often, you know, important to understand how these things end up here. Even though sometimes they end up in other places, but particularly when it comes to churches, and it happens to many churches as we move on, and it was something I mentioned a bit more later, but a lot of the churches that end up being Baroque are not necessarily originally Baroque. They're either medieval or even Renaissance churches that have been redone in a Baroque style to sort of fit in. So then they are essentially crammed with Baroque art to sort of go with everything else that is around. So you can't properly understand paintings that were originally commissioned to be in one of those churches without really getting the grasp and the feel for the church itself, because everything sort of had that purpose, if that makes sense.
Exactly. It's one thing to see in a museum, which is great. I love museums. Oh, yeah. But seeing it where it's meant to be, it's powerful. Plus, when you're from America, like I am, and you walk into a church and you're like, oh my God, that's a Caravaggio. Like, what? It's just there?
Yeah.
It's kind of mind-boggling.
Absolutely.
Should we move on to my last little work?
Yes.
I'm so glad you brought up Rubens and his like crammed composition, because that's literally why I picked this next painting, because I just knew I couldn't talk about Baroque art with you without mentioning Rubens. So Peter Paul Rubens, one of my other favorite artists. I can't pick. I have a very hard time doing this, but I love Peter Paul Rubens because he just did his thing and he got really famous for it. And I think his work is absolutely stunning, and especially its use of color. So I chose to talk about The Descent from the Cross, which is actually in Antwerp. So we're moving away from Italy a little bit up north. And it was painted between 1612 and 1614. And it is still at the Cathedral of Our Lady, that it was commissioned for, which is another important thing because we can see how it interacts with the building itself. So The Descent from the Cross is exactly what it sounds like. It's the early Christian group taking Christ's body down from the cross after the events of the Passion and the Crucifixion. And as Lily mentioned earlier, it has our classic tight diagonal composition of Rubens. He crams, let me count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people into one painting, and there's hardly any space between them. Because he can, and you can tell it's also Rubens because his figures are kind of chunky and muscular because he was highly influenced by Michelangelo when he traveled to Italy to learn how to work in the style of the old masters. And Michelangelo, kind of like Bernini and Caravaggio, he's everywhere. You cannot escape him. And what I think is so fascinating about this is Christ looks dead. In previous periods, Christ kind of just looked like he was sleeping. But in this work, it's sad. He's got blood running from the wounds on his wrists and his feet and his side. His body has almost a grayish hue to it, as if he had just died. He's muscular, like he can't escape Michelangelo's influence, but he's also very limp. And so immediately, because it's in the center of this strong diagonal line, it hits you. Like, Christ is dead. He hasn't resurrected yet. We don't know he's going to be resurrected. So he, all of a sudden, this movement, this powerful movement is over. And it's jarring. Even if you're not Christian, but you know the history of Christianity, it's very moving. Oh, yeah. And then on the bottom left of the painting, if you're facing it, we've got the three women, his mother and Mary Magdalene, and there's some talk of who the other woman is, but it's not important for this discussion. And they're sad. They're reaching out towards him. Their faces are forlorn, as if they can't believe that he's dead. While the other men are more stoic, and they're working on pulling him down from the cross. And it's just a tragic painting that makes you really contemplate the sacrifice that Christ had made. And that was the goal of the work, again, to bring people back to the church, to remember their roots of being Catholic. And Peter Paul Rubens, despite being from the north where the Reformation was more prevalent, he was a devout Catholic. So he made a lot of works, but for praying come back to Catholicism.
Yep. I don't have a lot to mention on this one. I would like to say another painting that he also does, which is in both of them, these are done, if I remember correctly, right after he comes back to the Netherlands, mm-hmm. after being in Italy for quite some time. And the Raising of the Cross was the first proper masterpiece for an Olivet triptych. So it's both of them, because he manages to keep the symmetry, not just within the paintings, but in the triptych itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the thing, and I hope this becomes perfectly clear to anyone listening to this. There is, if you know, you have different artists, they all have their strengths and whatnot. Bernini is definitely a statue, but if you ever went and ridiculous, and it's amazing with such a sort of don't new. This is something that's been done so many times, and yet he manages to make it his own. And one of the reasons, I think at least, that Rubens really manages to make this such an iconic piece for him is because all that time, and he puts it in the, he blends both styles together, making, I've wanted to highlight earlier when I was saying that it doesn't just come, the sort of style of Baroque in Italy was a little bit different from the style that we see in the Netherlands. And Rubens just manages to mix them both together. And that's the reason why sometimes when you have an art gallery and you have Baroque and you go from someone like Caravaggio to then, is this even the same sort of style? But that's why it often comes down to the artist themselves creating almost a micro niche, if you like, of their own personal sort of creativity, which is what makes Baroque just fascinating. And I just sort of wanted to point that out because it's Rubens and it's awesome. And there is other versions of the same painting done later on, but I definitely think that this is perhaps the most iconic because of that realism brought to the body, how it sort of flops whilst it's dead. Like it almost makes you feel a little bit gruesome, you know, like mm-hmm. a little bit like, oh, I don't necessarily want to look at that. I mean, you're still looking at it because it's damn gorgeous, but it's like, ah, and that's really the extent to which Baroque goes. There's almost like no boundaries, and that's the reason why we end up with these, you know, these type of images of people and other things taken to the extreme because of that. Again, I said it earlier, but that desire to bring the plausibility in front of you just pushes that imagination to boundaries that hadn't really been pushed before. So. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Jesus is a man in this work. He's not Jesus, yes, the Son of God. Exactly. And I think that's an important distinction for Baroque works, as you were saying, like, it puts it into the realm of the human. You know, Jesus isn't some divine figure here. He's someone who was executed by the Roman Empire. And I'm really glad you brought up the raising of the cross, because I haven't actually looked at these two side by side for many years.
Mm.
And I think it's really interesting that we've got, in the raising of the cross, we've got a diagonal going from bottom right to top left, but in the descent of the cross,
yes,
it's going the opposite direction. So it's like this continuity of the story. And I haven't actually noticed that before. And I'm blown away just thinking that far ahead of which goes one way we're telling a story.
Mm. Yep.
Wow. Oh, it's such a good comparison.
It's when you can see them, I mean, I really hope when you guys are listening, if you put them both next to each other on your screen, it really brings things together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just wonderful. And again, you can see that diagonal and the contrast and everything is just amazing. Absolutely amazing. But yeah, there you go. That was really all I wanted to say about this, because I know if I start talking about Rubens, we will never end. and actually, this painting links in to something I wanted to mention very briefly, because he was not supposed to be my main thing, but I cannot talk about Baroque and let this go. So if I'm allowed, the reason why I wanted to sort of, and I was hoping this would come up, is because that sort of feeling of the body and the realism, it's also very palpable in one of my favorite paintings from one of my favorite artists of all times, which is Rembrandt. And I'm talking about The Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Nicolae Stulp.
I love that work.
This is a very famous painting because it brings the gruesome into the reality of events, which is, this is actually the painting is a bunch of people looking over a dead body, which is being performed an autopsy. And you see the dead body very much in the same way you see Jesus in the painting we've just spoken about from Rubens. And then you see the left arm, I believe it is, or the right arm, I think it's the left arm, completely open up and the insides of the arm being prodded about whilst the Dr. Nicolae Stulp is giving this lecture to his students.
Yeah.
And it's quite peculiar because I don't think there is anything quite like this in the rest of Baroque or in anything else. And that's because Rembrandt was, he's a genius and he's a master of Baroque. But I think sometimes he sort of stays in his own little niche and a bit pushed aside by people like Caravaggio and Rubens. Not that I am saying, you know, they are not all the same, but I think what is so peculiar about Rembrandt and all of his paintings is that they have that little quirky something everywhere. Even in the portraits that Rembrandt does, there's something a bit strange, off, or bewildering, if that makes sense. That makes you think, huh, where did that come from? But in any way, the story behind this painting, which, by the way, was done in 1632, he's actually recording something that happened at the Amsterdam Guild of Surgeons, which was an actual public dissection that was done on the 31st of January. And they were using the body of a criminal to show future surgeons and practitioners how the inside of a human body works. And that's what Rembrandt decided to capture in this painting, which is, you know, completely quirky, kooky, and unlike anything else. And the other reason why I wanted to mention this painting is because it's also one of those scenes from history and art history that then has found its way to many different pieces in popular culture, whether it's books or movies or whatever. I think there is even a video game, I think it's Deus Ex, I read this earlier, where there are references to the painting throughout the game, because it is such a bizarre little thing that was done, and it obviously was so impactful. I mean, everything else that you see here is very classic Rembrandt. You see a lot of black and white contrast. You know, this is the typical dress of the period. It is a very typical type of paraphernalia that you see almost every single image that he does of a man and of a Flemish painter in general. But everything else is ordinary up until you reach this moment. And if you notice as well, the heads sort of form a diagonal that take you to the centerpiece, which is that hand, which is being dissected. And even if you sort of start looking at the faces, one of the faces is looking straight at you, even though it should be looking down at the arm.
Definitely makes it seem like a photograph.
It's kind of weird. And it's 100%. But that is also another wonderful thing that happens a lot in Baroque. There is always, if you start looking at these paintings, there is those little cues left everywhere that sort of are inviting you to be part of that conversation. Yeah. But that is something that I think that the person that I want to talk about does a lot better than Rembrandt. Not that I have anything against Rembrandt, like I said, is one of my favorites, but it's Velázquez. I cannot go through a discussion of Baroque being Spanish and not mention Velázquez.
That's why I left him for you, because I knew you would want to talk about him. So I was like, man, I'm going to let her handle him. But can I say something really quick about the anatomy lesson?
100%.
First of all, some viewer discretion is advised. It's really gross looking. It makes my toes curl. Like, I just don't like that part of it. But the part of the guy looking straight out at you, it's almost like accusatory, his glance, and that's part of the interaction with the viewer that Baroque art is so famous for, because it's like, excuse me, why are you in this room? Like, you aren't allowed in here, because they only did this once a year. Like, this was a big deal, and it was an exclusive event for these future doctors, and so it's almost as if, like, we aren't even allowed in the space yet. It's not real, but it feels real. It cracks me up. Like, that guy just looks so angry. Yeah, he looks so mad at me. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't even want to look at this. Like, So I just love that Rembrandt is able to capture that feeling, and that it transcends time. Like, this painting was painted in 1632. It's 2021, and I still feel like I've offended someone. Like, that is the mark of a true artist, if you ask me.
100%. I think it's just, like I said, and I think that's the reason why I can sympathize a lot more with people like Rembrandt than Bernini. Because Bernini wouldn't have done that, that makes sense. He would have sculpted the most beautiful dead body that you could ever see, but he wouldn't have done that. And if he would have done that, it would have been adorned in such a way that it wouldn't have made it gruesome or realistic in that sense. And that's the reason why, for me, it's difficult. Yet I see that Rembrandt, and I'm like, yep, I'm here for all of these people. and there we go. But on that front of actually presenting things as they are, it's another reason why I love Velázquez. Because, I mean, like I said, in the same way that we can talk about Rubens and Baroque for hours, Velázquez is not just one of the most prolific painters of Spanish history, period, but one of the most prolific painters of all time. Like, even if we just go through his sketches and everything else, it's amazing. And this guy did almost everything. He started from, some of his earliest works are something called bodegones in Spanish, which actually signified, a bodega is sort of not necessarily the kitchen, but like a cellar where you keep food. And it's, a lot of people think that is this sort of typical still life type of painting. But if you sort of put a bodegón from a Spanish painter from the Baroque, and particularly Velázquez, next to the Flemish painters, which were actually a lot prolific in this topic as well, you just realize that everything is very different, because the Spanish bodegones have very hard lines and some very simple traits, and there is still a degree of geometric sort of residue from mannerism. But the big thing about these bodegones is that the simplicity is sort of given a dark twist, because they're full of tenebrism, the different light contrasts and whatnot just make them look a bit sort of ooh. And that is done on purpose, because this moment in time and the period in time where Velázquez lives, I mean, he was born in Seville in sort of 1599. Well, that's actually when he was baptized. He may have been born a little bit earlier, but, you know, we're literally right at the end of the 16th century and onto the 17th century. And by this moment in time, Spain is completely in ruins. You know, nothing about Spain is good, but the art makes up for everything bad that happened in Spain at the time. So, you know, and a lot of it we owe it to Velázquez and the amount of work that he got commissioned, which often came from the royal household. But yeah, they are very interesting things happening with Spanish art here. And Velázquez is the the easy example because he's so prolific, but also because he set that benchmark that not everyone can reach. And I want to take a bit of time to explain to you guys that I cannot really say it in any other way. And maybe this is very, very sort of, I guess, typical, but Spanish Baroque, it genuinely is different from the rest of Europe. And I think that's also the reason why then we see it so much in America. Like, it took really like fire in Mexico and the Philippines as well. A lot of it was because the Jesuits, who actually did a lot of the, not so much conversion, but the cementation of Catholicism in the New World on behalf of the Spanish monarchy, took that art style with them. A lot of the big Baroque churches that we have in Spain are often from the Jesuit orders, and it's sort of one thing led to another. But it's that it really has its own little quirks, and Velázquez brings this in very well. I have a very hard time picking just one painting from Velázquez, and I didn't want to talk about the very classic, obvious example, which is Las Meninas, because I think everyone sort of knows this painting. In case you don't, go to Google and you will go like, oh yeah, I know that painting. You know, it's the three sort of little girls, actually five little girls in their huge Baroque dress. Like everything about that painting is Baroque. The way the painting is done, the way the art is done, the dresses, the hair, everything is over the top.
I did not know that painting, but I do.
Didn't you? Oh, well, there you go. But my
very, very, very famous.
My favorite Velázquez of all times, and I inserted this the way I could in when I was teaching this in uni, is the Surrender of Breda, which is or La Rendición de Breda, which is also known as Las Lanzas, which means the lances in English, because it's a very important historical moment for the history of Spain, or at least for the person that was commissioning this painting from Velázquez. And it really tells you a lot about what's happening in Spanish history at the moment. You know, Spain is fighting wars against the Netherlands, which is funny because it's the two main sources of amazing Baroque art that we have during this period. And Breda ends up surrendering to Spain and sort of putting an end to part of the war in here. But what I love about this painting is, A, it brings the historical theme into the general picture of the Baroque. You know, so far we've seen a lot of the church and whatnot, which was obviously very important, but history encapsulated in a painting was very, very Baroque. And I think part of it was because, like I said, there was all this political stuff happening in the world. People wanted to immortalize these moments one way or another. And that's why this painting of Breda for me is quite amazing. But also because if you look at it, it doesn't necessarily scream that it should be Baroque. It's not particularly dark. It's actually quite colorful. The exchange in between the people is quite amicable for some people that are surrendering to you know, to another nation. And obviously there is some political propaganda, and I won't go into that there, but there is political propaganda because the man that is commissioning this painting is the man that is painted there in the middle. It's Ambrosio, which was good friends with Velázquez. And it's just a very dynamic painting. And remember earlier I said about the perspective, you kind of have one, two, three, even four layers in this painting. And it's not done with a diagonal, although you can see different diagonals here and there. But the colors are used beautifully here to give you the first sort of caption of this painting, which is Breda and the people of Breda giving the keys over to Spain. And again, you can see several faces looking into you and sort of pulling you in like, oh, you're here. Oh, okay, never mind. You see this horse giving you its back, which is quite sort of weird. It's like, oh, here is my horse. It's the back of my horse. Admire it. And it's a wonderful horse. And then you see the smoke of the battlefield, the cannons, the destruction, you know, it starts having layers. It starts telling you the story of what's happened here and how it's presenting Spain and Ambrosio in this particular case as a very magnanimous, like, oh, here are the Spanish coming to put some peace amongst the poor people of the Netherlands. And that's kind of how the narrative goes. here Velázquez maybe was trying to flatter his friend, which is, you know, fair enough. At the end of the day, he was getting money from this. But Velázquez was actually well known for not sort of sugarcoating things. And there is several other paintings that he did, particularly portraits. And actually, he's one of the biggest portrait makers of time and of this period, where he did nothing to flatter the actual people he was working with. And one of the most famous ones, I'll mention that very, very, very briefly, is his portrait of Philip IV in Brown and Silver. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, if you look at the painting itself, there is not much to the painting other than just Philip IV there with his ridiculous dress and in the background. And you look at that man and you think, he doesn't look particularly handsome. And it's not because Velázquez had anything against Philip, but Philip actually looked like this. There was a big issue with the Spanish monarchy, with the late Habsburgs. They were all inbreds, and there were some serious deformations and some serious interesting faces in the family. And in fact, this is the king after Philip IV that became so ridden by disease and deformities that becomes completely unable to rule and eventually passes the rule over to the French monarchy in Spain. But what I wanted to say about this is, you see the amount of detail he goes into that dress. Like, mm-hmm. you can almost see every single stroke of the pencil making the little rivets and whatnot in there. And then you go to the face and it's almost completely flat. That's because that's how Philip IV was. And Philip IV actually got really pissed off with Velázquez because of this. Because he expected him and wanted him to paint, you know, to make him look good, to make him look appealing. Yeah, yeah. And Velázquez refused under the premise that as a true artist, he had to capture reality as it was. Uh-huh. And he did this after a few times. There is a few other paintings where you sort of think, that's not a particularly pleasant face to look at. Or, you know what I mean? There is these weird things that you would think artists wouldn't do. But Velázquez does, because that's how truly committed to his cause is. And, you know, this is how we end up with this type of amazing sort of realism coming through.
That definitely seems the case with a lot of portraits from this style. Yeah.
Yes.
They're realistic and you think, oh, that definitely looks like a real person.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I mean,
not always in a nice way.
No, not at all. But, you know, and we know he probably wasn't, you know, doing any exceptions, because in the Meninas there is an autoportrait of himself, and he looks actually quite ordinary in that sense. Like, it doesn't seem like he's gone through you know, lengths to make himself look better or anything like that. But yeah, it's interesting as well, because at the time when he was painting, a lot of people kind of looked over his shoulder and they considered him a lot inferior than people later have. And in Spain, you cannot study art without seeing Velázquez. And these days in Europe, you cannot really go through a Baroque program without addressing the fact that Velázquez did his own thing. And Spanish Baroque sort of took on a whole new level after he was, you know, in the picture. So there you go. This is what I wanted to say about Velázquez and Baroque. And knowing that we're running out of time, I will mention my last thing very, very quickly, which is a building or a set of buildings and an architectural style. And for this, I find myself sort of falling into some patterns here, because I am taking us to a civil building that it's in Salamanca, which is a town in Spain. And I'm referring to the Plaza Mayor, which essentially means the main square in Salamanca. And I wanted to talk to you guys about a little bit of architecture, just because I like buildings in general. And instead of talking about churches, I really wanted to talk about this plaza, because it's done in a style that is completely authentic and very special to Spain, which is called Churriguera style. Okay. It comes from the original artist that put it out there. His name was José Benito Churriguera. And what characterizes this type of architectural buildings is that they have a lot of stucco decorations. And that's, it's not necessarily the fact that this is not ordinary, but it's a material that is used a lot in Spain that perhaps is not used so much in other parts of Europe, and that actually is really much embraced in the New World. And we see this a lot, particularly in Mexico and again in the Philippines, right, like I mentioned earlier. So it's super detail oriented, and it became, I mean, Churriguera himself worked a lot in some of the major towns in Spain. He did a lot of work in Madrid. He did a lot of work in Salamanca, not just in La Plaza Mayor, but in Salamanca overall. And he is also very famous for doing the facade of the Cathedral of Granada in 1667. And I sort of just wanted to bring this in, because again, this sort of shows how peculiar and how quirky these tiles can go into, because this plaza is actually done a little later than Velázquez. He started in 1729, and it took nearly 30 years to be completed. I think it gets finished halfway through the 18th century. So now you see how late we're going into Baroque. Mm-hmm. You know, the rest of Europe is moving on, and Spain is like, yeah, Baroque, Churriguera style, you know, because it was so popular, and they really made it its own thing. You know, you almost spend two centuries of Baroque in Spain, which is great for someone like me, but you know, some people don't see it that way. These plaza, I mean, this is a very common design in most Spanish towns and in any other towns, but in Spain in particular, the Plaza Mayor is sort of like the main town square where either there is an important building or a lot of commerce, and it was almost designed as a place for social gatherings. You know, a lot of these towns didn't exist previously in Spain. A lot of them start being rebuilt as towns during this time, and it was sort of a way of sort of reorganizing social life, if you like. And they decided, boom, we're just going to make this sort of big communal space. And this square in particular was originally used for bullfighting. Of course, it's not these days anymore. But in plazas, and it was the same in the case of Plaza Mayor in Madrid, these type of spectacles would be, you know, put on, whether it was a bullfighting or whether it was theater, it would be quite common. And it's an aspect of Spanish society, which is still very much the case. And I'm sure if you see, you know, current pictures of Plaza Mayor in Salamanca or in Madrid, that's what you will see. You'll mostly see people. You probably won't have time to actually appreciate the buildings around you, because the people are there, and they sort of become the epicenter of the city life, if that makes sense. Interestingly, and I mean, this is obviously entirely up to interpretation, but it is considered one of the most beautiful plazas in Spain. I mean, it's nice. I've been there, but I'm not entirely sure if I would take the statement that far. Whatever, you know, I'll take it or leave it.
It looks pretty big, pretty ornate.
Oh yeah, it's very, very big. And it's, you know, it's interesting because Salamanca itself is not that big city, but this plaza was sort of making a big, big, you know, statement.
Putting it on the map.
This is Salamanca, and Salamanca actually received a lot of benefit from the Churriguera family, and definitely from Philip V. So it really helped the development of the city, having such an artist that became sort of, you know, renowned, even if just locally, to have something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason why I wanted to talk about this, sort of to draw a comparison to when I spoke about the Aqueduct of Segovia in the previous one, is because often we go around our daily lives without noticing. I mean, in the case of Segovia, if you don't notice the aqueduct, then you must be looking at the floor. But, you know, we go around our daily lives without realizing that these things, you know, are there. These parts of history that really make it or break it, and artistic pieces that perhaps we don't think about, like a plaza, because it has a functional space, they were still designed with something in mind, such as making people feel this was truly the best plaza in the world, or certainly in Spain. And that's very much what I think Felipe kind of wanted to promote here, and what Churriguera really worked really hard to do, sort of make this the plaza, if that makes sense. And it's something that you can still see in a lot of Spanish architecture. That wasn't damaged during the Civil War, obviously, but that sort of, when it comes to a Baroque building and it's in a public space, you know, even in a public space, the details go over the top. And that's to make you aware that this is one thing Spanish people can do very well and a very important part of Spanish art. It's everywhere.
Go over the top.
Yeah, 100%. And it genuinely sort of becomes a trademark. It legit becomes a trademark. And, you know, it's the one thing Spanish people are proud of, that despite the empire was lost, everything was doomed, we managed to make fantastic buildings like that.
We can still be overwhelming.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just one of those things. The city of Salamanca itself these days is a World Heritage Site, just very much like Segovia. And there is actually a plaque in the plaza to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Salamanca being Patrimony of Humanity. So, you know, maybe it's not the most beautiful plaza in the world, but it definitely makes an impact and it is huge. So if you have some time and just go around Spain, you will see loads of buildings like this. But this is such an example because it really brings together the functionality of architecture, art and society all in one place. And with the background of the politics, obviously, if you're aware of them, they're very, very important. But the other reason why I wanted to mention this plaza is because it wasn't just José Benito Churriguera. In fact, it wasn't him at all, but it was part of the Churriguera family. And it's interesting how sometimes, you know, the legacy of one artist can be so big that it becomes a family effort. Because when the plaza was originally being built, they were working under the direction of Alberto Churriguera. But then when the second phase comes about, it's already another person, which is actually the nephew of the original director, which becomes Manuel de Larra Churriguera. And finally, it had to be finished by someone else who was not part of the family, but that imitated the Churriguera style to sort of keep everything tied together. And that is Andrés García de Quiñones. And that's what I wanted to say about Baroque art, kind of to really home in what I was saying earlier at the beginning of the podcast, that Baroque wasn't just about the excessive artistic expression. It genuinely took over people's lives. And that's the reason why it also received a lot of backlash when we move, you know, a bit forward, and why some people sort of dismissed it as sort of grotesque because it was a bit too much. But in the case of Spain, too much was just good enough. So there you go.
I've never actually seen this building before, and I just learned a ton about it, and it's absolutely beautiful. I looked it up on Google.
Yeah, no, it's a nice one. I mean, I've been in Salamanca. It's one of those places where sort of no matter where you are in Spain, it sort of becomes a school trip of one kind or another.
Right. Yeah.
And I never went there. I actually ended up there because I was in a, I was doing a conservation dig somewhere else, and we ended up in Salamanca because they took us on a bus trip. And Salamanca is small, but it's beautiful. And this type of stone, I don't know if you can see in the picture, depending how good it is or not, you may not be able to see it. It has almost like a yellowish quality to it.
Right.
And that is actually a local stone that you will see only in the area of Salamanca, in lots of buildings. It's not just in the plaza, but I believe it's also in the library and in some of the other local churches and even the cathedral. And it sort of really homes in that idea of how important that unique personality is in you know, for Spanish art, and particularly during the Baroque. Because, you know, it's abundant in the area, but obviously that would have taken a lot of resources, and it was obviously dedicated to some of the most special buildings to sort of really make you feel, this is Salamanca, you know, without being Sparta, but you know what I mean, in the same sort of tone. So it's, yeah, it definitely has a quality that if you are there, you notice it and you appreciate it a lot more, particularly on a rainy day when the light is not so bright. I mean, on a sunny day, it's almost like a solarium because it's light reflecting from everywhere. And obviously it makes the space look even bigger, which is bonkers because the plaza is already huge. But on a rainy day or on a cloudy day, when you can actually just sort of stay put and there's not many people hanging around and you can just look at it, it's just really characteristic. And, you know, that's really something that the Churriguera family was very good at doing as well, bringing that personality into their pieces.
Hmm. Nice.
Fascinating. I did not know anything about that. So, well, thank you for sharing.
There you go. I was really struggling for a while as to what quirky thing, because I really wanted to make a special place for Spanish Baroque here, not just because I love it and because I'm Spanish, but because it's sincerely so quirky in comparison to some of the other styles that I was thinking, which one will I bring in? And I sort of settled for Plaza Mayor in Salamanca, because if you are going to mention Churriguera, this kind of just makes it very clearly. I mean, the cathedral in Granada is very well known and all of that, but I thought, you know, right, what, let's bring something that is not so churchy like, because that's not just what Baroque is about. Let's bring the second dimension or the third dimension, whatever we are at this moment of the podcast, and sort of see.
I'm jealous because you have cool art from where you're from, because there's no such thing as Pacific Northwest Baroque.
Well, no, I was going to say there was a revival, I think, of Baroque in California. I think, I don't know if it's one of the main churches in some of the areas, but obviously California was very heavily converted and populated by Spanish people. And the Jesuits there set several churches, and there was a revival of Baroque art that sort of came as a third wave from Mexico and the Baroque art that Mexican people had already borrowed from Spain. And so there is some, but it's a bit too far from where you are. So I'm afraid.
Yeah. And a lot of Seattle was lost in a big fire from an earthquake. Yeah. So there's like an entire underground part of Seattle. Great ghost, scary tour if you're interested. But yeah, we don't really have any. Seattle's very modern, and they don't really care about old buildings. And it hurts my little historian heart.
It happens. I mean, it's a problem for cities of this day and age, you know. History leaves its marks for sure, and sometimes that means taking away some of the personality and characteristics of the city. Like the city where I live in the UK is very much the same, because it got torn to shreds during the Blitz, and the city where I come from in Spain had a huge fire as well, right at the beginning of the 20th century, and it just took the entire city by storm. So all of it was rebuilt in just cement, essentially, which is not very pleasant.
Yeah, there's always a fire or something in history of any city. So
yeah,
one
of the other reasons why a lot of the Baroque buildings survive, not just in Spain but across Europe and in the New World, is because part of the grandeur and the effort that was thrown into making them was also so that they would be as durable as possible. Because they were already, in some cases, you know, changing pre-existing buildings to make them more modern. Sometimes in order to preserve some of the original stuff, they sort of had to build over it. And for that, they needed to make sure that thing wasn't going to collapse on top of, you know, the previous medieval cathedral or whatever it was. So a lot of the time, they're sort of big, bulky buildings, but they have that sort of durability impact. And that's also the same reason why the mobiliary art I was mentioning at the beginning, it's so prominent in France, because it was built to last. Because when you make something that cool, you don't want it to, you know, break to pieces just a few years later. So
it's not IKEA furniture.
No, it definitely isn't IKEA furniture. For sure. And I think that's probably all we have time for today. I'm aware that we've probably gone a little bit over the time that we had allocated for this.
That's fine. I was expecting you two to go on even longer, but that's okay.
Well, you know, like we said, it's just there's so much to cover with Baroque, and this is generally just the top of the iceberg. Like there is so much, but it is a crucial moment for art and architecture and everything in Europe and in the world in general. And because there is so much of it, I think it tends to cause a lot of confusion. So I kind of wanted to bring it here and make it a bit more accessible, which is what, well, Annalisa does for a living. So
well, there we go.
Yeah.
That was a good bit of accessible art history. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was definitely educational for me, and I'm sure for other people who are listening. So,
well, if you learned something, considering your aversion to art, then we've done a good job.
What do you keep saying that for?
You know what I mean. I'm teasing you.
I find it interesting. I just don't know much about it.
Nope, that's fair. That's what we are here for.
Exactly. Okay. Like I like to always say, it's a quote from Beauty and the Beast, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yep.
Exactly. I was waiting to work that in because it's my favorite quote from a Disney movie.
Good job.
It's great.
Nice one. And on that bombshell, let's end.
Well, thank you so much, guys, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.